opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Cyberspace is a place that only a human being locates, where there's so much information to take. Then you enter an entirely new page. Once you get off the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary, on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Road.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
Cliff, you're listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griffin, Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
And welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind, on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. Start off the program, the Commodores, Heroes, as we celebrate the natal day of a genuine hero. Malcolm Little, also known as Detroit Red, Satan, Malcolm X, and finally, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. The names alone demonstrate a transitionary period in his relatively short life. And we'll talk about Malcolm X. We'll share some pieces from speeches that he made over the years just to get a feel for what he was about and all the issues that he addressed and why he is so significant, particularly amidst the controversy of a recent book put out by Manning Marable, who has since made his transition. I have not read the book. I've seen some of the comments and the controversy, and I don't want to get into it, obviously, because I haven't read the book, but we need to remember Malcolm. Those of us who were alive when he was alive should share our thoughts, our opinions, and our impressions of him. Malcolm was a much more complex person than was depicted either by Alex Haley or Spike Lee. So this may help you get more information on Malcolm so that you know for yourself. We'll share a commentary that we did recently. You know, what would Malcolm say about Barack Obama? We'll hear that following these messages. Don't go anywhere. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind, right here on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. Stay tuned.
Greetings to the Internet Radio family. This is Reverend Valentine speaking. You know, for nearly 30 years, I have had the distinct experience of being interviewed over every medium of communication available to the public. And except for the metaphysical underground, I can think of no other electronic venue that has been more progressive, more innovative, more insightful, more diligent, more diverse in its demographics, and more courageously supportive of the truth than this ever-growing phenomenon called Internet radio. And this is precisely why I'm here to tell you that it is so vital that you give your wholehearted support to it. Tell a friend. In fact, tell 2, 3, and 4 of your friends. If you are a business owner, support Internet radio by telling your customers and constituents all about it. Let them know that there is a legitimate and important substitute to all of the prefabricated, super-censored garbage polluting our public airways today. Don't allow the mass media to continue to treat you like a mindless consumer drone. Enhance your awareness. Indulge your critical thinking, your reasoning, and your analysis. Do as I do. Log on, listen in, and then let it be known all about your internet radio experience. Chimatep, beloved family, thank you for listening. Walk in light.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com, or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support. You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned. As we come out of the break, we're going to share our latest piece, What Would Malcolm Say About Obama? Quote, the real religion of Islam doesn't teach anyone to judge another human being by the color of his skin. The yardstick that is used by the Muslim to measure another man is not the man's color, but his deeds, his conscious behavior, the man's intention, and when you use that as the standard of measurement, you never go wrong. But when you just judge a man because of the color of his skin, you are committing a crime because that's the worst kind of judgment, unquote. El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. As we pause to honor the life, legacy, and memory of Malcolm Little, a.k.a. Detroit Red, Satan, Malcolm X, and finally El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, on his natal day, May 19th, we learn he was a committed seeker of truth, who was uncompromising in his quest for justice and right. Based upon his love of black people and what he stood for, his worldview and evolving philosophy, it is good we pay homage and respect to him. Malcolm was a model for us. He demonstrated personal redemption and transformation are possible even in an insane society such as ours. Malcolm was born into a family that believed in race first. His parents were avid and active Garveyites. Later, despite severe social hardship following the death of his father, his mother being institutionalized due to an emotional breakdown, Malcolm fell into a culture of depravity and crime. But when he was exposed to the teaching of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad while in prison, he saw the light. Malcolm made a conscious decision to change. He rekindled his dormant pursuit of intellectual growth and personal development. He honed his reading and oratory skills after he joined the Nation of Islam, and he was eventually elevated by Mr. Muhammad to become the national spokesperson for the Nation of Islam. The socially and politically conscious Malcolm was on a collision course with the status quo. Malcolm helped spread the teaching of Elijah Muhammad and had a huge hand in the growth of the movement. But Malcolm disobeyed Mr. Muhammad when he commented publicly on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Mr. Muhammad had warned his ministers not to say anything controversial about Kennedy's assassination because the nation was in mourning and folks were caught up in the emotion of it all. But when asked by the media for a statement, Malcolm spoke truth to power by saying the U.S. had assassinated leaders all over the world and now the chickens had come home to roost. Malcolm's keen insight into geopolitics, as truthful as it was, created a rift between him and the Nation of Islam hierarchy, which eventually led him to leave the Nation of Islam and start his own Pan-African organization. This rift was ultimately capitalized upon by the U.S. government's covert counterinsurgency program called COINTELPRO as a cover to assassinate Malcolm. Malcolm was building a case and planning to take the U.S. before the World Court for human rights violation. He traveled extensively to Africa and Asia to gain support for his plan. Just the notion a black man had the audacity to attempt such a thing sent chills down the spines of the U.S. government and their puppet masters. It would have been a disaster for the U.S. image. The U.S. government could not afford to allow Malcolm to continue. Given what we know of Malcolm and his unwillingness to compromise, tiptoe or soft shoe around the critical issues of his day, and his willingness to take a principled stand no matter how controversial, we can surmise what he would say about Barack Obama. First of all, Malcolm exposed shuffling, handkerchief-head Negroes everywhere he encountered them. He could see their true motives. He knew they were puppets working for a ruthlessly oppressive system. Malcolm opposed imperialist wars. He vocally opposed the Vietnam War early on, even before the war escalated to the point it was all-consuming, because he saw it for what it was, a racist, imperialist projection of white supremacy, the U.S. picking up where the French left off. Based upon these facts, I have no hesitancy stating Malcolm would be one of the first to denounce Barack Obama as a warmonger and puppet of the multinational corporations, international financiers, and the military-industrial complex. He would probably be even more vociferous in his criticism because Obama is biracial and his father was an African. El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz would have discerned Obama was selected by the ruling elites to do their bidding, just as he denounced the impotent, handkerchief-head Negro politicians of his era. The fact the U.S. under Obama, in concert with other European nations, is openly waging war in Africa, in Somalia, and Libya, and covertly in Cote d'Ivoire, would have incensed Malcolm. Obama's forays into Pakistan would really make him persona non grata to Malcolm, especially since those countries I mentioned are Muslim countries. Malcolm spoke out against the draft and going to war. He said, quote, "We who declare ourselves to be righteous Muslims should not participate in wars which take the lives of humans. As Muslims, we don't go to war. We don't get drafted, and we don't join anyone's army. We don't teach you not to go because they would put us in jail for sedition. I would never tell you not to go. I wouldn't be that dumb. But I will tell you, if you are dumb enough to go, that's on you. If you are dumb enough to fight for someone who means you no good, if you're dumb enough to fight for something you've never gotten, if you're dumb enough, like some of your brothers, to go to fight in Korea and come back and still caught hell, or the older ones who fought in World War II and came back here, came back to this country, like Isaac Word, who got his eyes put out by the police right here in this country, well, go right ahead. But I'm not that dumb. For me, and I can only speak for myself, I'll go to jail. I'll go to prison first. We do not believe that this nation should force us to take part in such wars, for we have nothing to gain from it." Unquote. Malcolm would see the volunteer military and its mercenaries the U.S. is using all around the world and denounce them for what they are: hypocrites, warmongering troublemakers working against the best interests of humanity. When Obama staged the hoax about the killing of the long-dead Osama bin Laden 2 weeks ago, unthinking black folks were giddy. Many fell for the okey-doke, saying, "Obama's a bad man, he's the man." As astute as Malcolm was, if he were alive today, I'm sure he would have something to say not only about the Osama bin Laden scam, but about 9/11 as well. How the government's narrative on both of these are as phony as $3 bills. Malcolm would chide brainwashed Negroes for being so gullible and silly. He would remind us of the atrocities the U.S. government has committed against black and brown people over the years, and the lies it regularly tells about everything. In fact, Malcolm would be so vocal and so persuasive and so on point to seek justice in a world court, the U.S. would probably kill him. What would Malcolm say about Obama? And you can see it at seeingblack.com and also several of the Yahoo listservs, such as like Sons of Africa, Unite and Resist campaign, The Blacklist, and many, many others. Today we celebrate the natal day of Malcolm Little, also called Detroit Red, Satan, Malcolm X, and El Haj Malik El Shabazz. Malcolm Little was born on May 19, 1925, in Omaha, Nebraska. And he was born into a family that were avid black nationalists, avid and active followers of Marcus Mosiah Garvey. And so that seed was planted in him early on and in the hearts and minds of Malcolm and his siblings. And as I said in my commentary, once tragedy struck, his father was killed, his mother had a breakdown, and the family was split up and scattered, he fell into a life of crime. But when he was exposed to the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in prison, through the encouragement of his siblings, several of his siblings, that spark, that ember of wisdom and sobriety was rekindled in his heart, and he pursued it with a passion and enthusiasm that's unmatched in terms of enabling it to transform his life. And he did that. And that's why we're pausing here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary to honor Malcolm on his natal day.
He would have been 86 years old today, May 19th. And so we pause to pay our respects, to look back and reflect on the importance of Malcolm on our growth, our development, our transformation. And it's important that we see his life in that regard, not just taking it one segment or fragmenting it and separating it, but it's a whole process of birth, growth, development, a stint where he was cut off from his true self and got distracted into some degenerate activities, and he suffered the consequences of living in an insane society, and he made some poor choices. But then when he opened his mind and allowed himself to be receptive to a message through the encouragement of his siblings, it rekindled a spark that was in him, and that spark grew, and he did wonderful things. He became an avid reader. He was always bright by all accounts. He was very studious as a student, as a young person, but he was discouraged from pursuing what he wanted to be, which is an attorney. And then, of course, with the family tragedy, he got sidetracked. But once he made the decision to turn his life around and he became a member of the Nation of Islam, he committed himself and he became a soldier for Elijah Muhammad. And he was very good at what he did. He practiced his oratory skills. He was an avid reader. He was very, very bright. And the message of the Nation of Islam was pretty much like the message of Noble Drew Ali, and also the message of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, to teach our people a different mindset, a different reference point than that of the Negro, that of some invention, some caricature foisted upon us by our adversary, by our oppressor, by our jailer, by our slave master. And so I'm going to share a few snippets. One, he chides black and asks his audience to reflect or answer the question, who taught you to hate yourself? Because self-hatred is at the root of our situation. It's not the oppressive and violent and ruthlessness of our oppressor. It is, as Stephen Biko said, the mind is the most potent weapon and the tool of the oppressor. And that's what they've done. They've damaged our mind. They've turned our minds against us. We have been conditioned to hate ourselves. And Malcolm, after we hear this snippet, who taught you to hate yourself, he talks about the roots of self-hatred and talks about how to go about eradicating that self-hatred. This is a personal pursuit. Somebody else can't do it for you because it is your mind. And we need to take this lesson and begin to use it to save and redeem ourselves. So here it is.
Who taught you, please? Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask who yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you. We teach you to love the hair that God gave you. The most disrespected person in America is the black woman. The most unprotected person in America is the black woman. The most neglected person in America is the black woman. And as Muslims, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us to respect our women and to protect our women. And the only time a Muslim really gets real violent is when someone goes to molest his woman. We will kill you for our woman. I'm making it plain, yes. We will kill you for our woman. We believe that if the white man will do whatever is necessary to see that his woman gets respect and protection, then you and I will never be recognized as men until we stand up like men and place the same penalty over the head of anyone who puts his filthy hands out to put in the direction of our women.
Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who have been thoroughly brainwashed, who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a negative attitude toward yourself, a positive attitude toward yourself, and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully made you and me hate our African identity, our African characteristics. And you know yourself that we have been a people who hated our African characteristics. We hated our hair. We hated the shape of our nose. We wanted one of those long, dog-like noses, you know. Yeah. We hated the color of our skin. Hated the blood of Africa that was in our veins. And in hating our features and our skin and our blood, why, we had to end up hating ourselves. And we hated ourselves. Our color became to us a chain. We felt that it was holding us back. Our color became to us like a prison, which we felt was keeping us confined, not letting us go this way or that way. And we felt that all of these restrictions were based solely upon our color, and the psychological reaction to that would have to be that as long as we felt imprisoned or chained or trapped by black skin, black features, and black blood, that skin and those features and that blood that was holding us back automatically had to become hateful to us. And it became hateful to us. It made us feel inferior. It made us feel inadequate. It made us feel helpless. And when we fell victim to this feeling of inadequacy or inferiority or helplessness, we turned to somebody else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in another black man to show us the way, or black people to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't think a black man could do anything but play some horn, you know, some sound, and make you happy with some songs, and in that way. But when an inferior thing, where our food, clothing, and shelter was concerned, and our education was concerned, we turned to the man. We never thought in terms of bringing these things into existence for ourselves. We never thought in terms of doing things for ourselves, because we felt helpless. And what made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves. One of the things that made the black Muslim movement grow was its emphasis upon things African. This was the secret to the growth of the black Muslim movement. African blood, African origin, African culture, African ties. And you'd be surprised. We discovered that deep within the subconscious of the black man in this country, he's still more African than he is American. He thinks that he's more American than African because the man is jiving him and the man is brainwashing him every day, telling him, you're an American, you're an American. Man, how could you think you're an American and you have never had any kind of American treat over here? You have never, never. 10 men can be sitting at a table eating, you know, dining. And I can come and sit down where they're dining. They're dining. I got a plate in front of me, but nothing is on it. Because all of us sitting at the same table are all of us diners. I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. Just being at the table with others who are dining doesn't make me a diner. And this is what you got to get in your head here in this country. Just because you're in this country doesn't make you an American. And no, you got to go farther than that before you can become an American. You got to enjoy the fruits of Americanism. And you haven't enjoyed those fruits. You've enjoyed the thorns. You've enjoyed the thistle, but you have not enjoyed the fruit. No, sir. So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance in 1965 of being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. I say that again that I'm not a racist. I don't believe in any form of segregation or anything like that. I'm for the brotherhood of everybody, but I don't believe in forcing brotherhood upon people who don't want it. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, and then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we practice it with them also, if we're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us. Thank you.
The one thing about Malcolm, he was very innovative as the national spokesperson for the Nation of Islam. He was instrumental in the formation of their propaganda organ, their newspaper, Muhammad Speaks. He was also a driving force behind the use of radio, where the nation would broker time on local radio stations. They didn't have national networks. They didn't have BET. They didn't have the Sheridan or Black Mutual back then. So what they would do was buy time on a lot of black-oriented stations. And keep in mind, in the late 50s, early 60s, there were only one or two black-owned radio stations. So they were taking a risk brokering time on these stations that were owned by whites. But they did it, and that's one of the reasons that the Nation of Islam, the black Muslim, so-called black Muslim movement, grew. And it was because of Malcolm's foresight and the openness of Elijah Muhammad and his inner circle to do that. The Nation of Islam held up a mirror to America and let it see itself. And of course, they couldn't stand it. They were aghast, and they rejected it. And so anytime you show the truth, they said that they were teaching hate. They said that they were inciting anti-white feelings, inflammatory rhetoric. But we'll hear Malcolm in this upcoming piece where he talks about the criminalization of black people, the demonization by the police and the mind control apparatus, the newspapers and television and radio. Now, keep in mind, television was relatively new in those days. It doesn't have the reach that it has today. They didn't have satellites. They didn't have internet streaming. But he understood the impact, and Elijah Muhammad, and to some degree, from what I can see, the inner circle of the Nation of Islam understood the impact of the brainwashing and conditioning that we had been subjected to. And Malcolm talks about that in this piece about criminalizing black people and demonizing us in the media. And this is something that goes on even to this day. It's just that today it's more subtle. They don't use the term Negro, you know, robber, John Jones, a Negro broke into so-and-so. But they use the pictures and they use the stereotypes that unfortunately we have brought into and we perpetuate. And it would be interesting to to speculate what Malcolm would say about black media, what Malcolm would say about BET, what Malcolm would say about Radio 1, what Malcolm would say about much of what's going on, or even what he would say about, say, a venue like this, the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul, or Living in Black, LIB, Kitty's station, or Harambe Radio, or any of the other stations. And so we'll listen to the keen insight that Malcolm had as he pinpointed and held up a mirror to America and showed America itself primarily to black people. You know, that his main audience was black people. And black folks, listen, you can hear the response to the crowds. The thing is, you know, what did those people do? Did they do like Malcolm? Did they make a change? Did they attempt to go on a journey of personal redemption and empowerment that is so sorely needed even today? Take a listen.
The controlled press, the white press, inflames the white public against Negroes. The police are able to use it to paint the Negro community as a criminal element. The police are able to use the press to make the white public think that 90% or 99% of the Negroes in the Negro community are criminals. And once the white public is convinced that most of the Negro community is a criminal element, then this automatically paves the way for the police to move into the Negro community, exercising Gestapo tactics, stopping any black man who is in on the sidewalk, whether he is guilty or whether he is innocent, whether he is well-dressed or whether he is poorly dressed, whether he is educated or whether he is dumb, whether he's a Christian or whether he's a Muslim. As long as he is black and a member of the Negro community, the white public thinks that the white policeman is justified in going in there and trampling on that man's civil rights and on that man's human rights. Once the police have convinced the white public that the so-called Negro community is a criminal element, they can go in and question, brutalize, murder unarmed, innocent Negroes, and the white public is gullible enough to back them up. This makes the Negro community a police state. This makes the Negro neighborhood a police state. It's the most heavily patrolled. It has more police in it than any other neighborhood, yet it has more crime in it than any other neighborhood. How can you have more cops and more crime? Why? It shows you that the cops must be in cahoots with the criminals.
It was almost inevitable that Malcolm would break from the Nation of Islam. If you go back and look at some of his speeches or some of the clips where he's on television, or you read some of his accounts in the newspapers, or read some of his own words, you can see that gradually he was diverging away from the strict orthodoxy of the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad. Classic examples: when they, meaning the LA police, broke into the mosque in Los Angeles, assaulted several of the men, I believe killed several, Malcolm was incensed. He was outraged at it and spoke about it in terms of not just the crime and the atrocity, but some get back, eye for an eye. And that was not the approach of Mr. Muhammad. Mr. Muhammad took the approach that their God, Allah, would take care of the oppressor, take care of the white man who they called the devil. And it would be in some kind of apocalyptic terms. And ironically, one of his books that explained this was called The Death of America. And if you look at it, some of his predictions are coming true. And I'm not saying this from the standpoint that I'm a follower of the doctrines of the Nation of Islam. I'm just making a point from my perspective. And so gradually you see Malcolm speaking out about social issues, particularly as the civil rights movement, so-called civil rights movement, heated up, particularly with the bombings and the pushback of the reactionaries in the South. But he also challenged the so-called liberals and the government. And he made, in no uncertain terms, he made it clear to folks that the government was equally responsible, and that the government had failed black people. And it was this type of thinking, and Malcolm, when he was in New York, had around him that some advisors who were non-Muslims, people like Dr. John Henry Clark and other folks he called his kitchen cabinet, who kept him abreast on issues. And Malcolm spoke out on all types of issues, particularly on the geopolitical scene as it related to Africa and the emerging countries, so-called liberated countries, coming out of hardcore colonialism and morphing into what we now know as neocolonialism. But he championed the rise of African nationalism. He identified with Africa, as we heard in the piece. And he was clear on a lot of the things that were going on. That's why he could make the comment when President Kennedy was assassinated, and when the press went to him. I mean, it wasn't like he was naive that he thought that the press really cared about what he thought or what the Nation of Islam thought. He knew that they were trying to stir up some kind of controversy given their position. That's why the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had warned folks, not to his ministers, not to say anything. But the urge to speak truth to power, I believe, overwhelmed him, and he said what he said. He said that the United States had assassinated leaders all over the world, had a hand in assassinating people all over the world. It was just a case of the chickens coming home to roost. And, of course, that led to his suspension, and there were some other things, and he eventually left the Nation of Islam. But even if that had not happened that way, I believe that eventually he would have left, because he saw so much going on, and he could not remain silent. He could not remain in a separatist, hands-off position. I believe he felt the time was right to get in get involved. As Vernon John said, if you see a good fight, get in it. And so he saw what was happening, and he got in it. He chose to get in it. But he took it to another level. He talked about human rights. And like Paul Robeson before him, he understood the impact of world opinion. And so his plan was to take the United States before a world court, before the world court in the United Nations, and charge this country with genocide. Excuse me. Charge the country with genocide and human rights violations, which would have been laughable if he didn't have the means to do so. And he was cultivating the means when he was in his process of leaving the Nation of Islam. And after he left, when he made trips around the world, or he would come, because he was in New York, go to the United Nations and meet with varying representatives and ambassadors. And of course, he was being tagged and he was being followed. In fact, when he was in, I believe it was when he was in Egypt, they tried to poison him. And then he was put on a list. And one time they wouldn't allow him to land. I believe it was in France. So he was persona non grata. And I'm sure that they were tapping his phone, and I'm sure that they knew what he was up to. And I'm sure they used the rift between him and the Nation of Islam hierarchy as a smokescreen to facilitate his assassination. The Bureau of Special Services, the New York police, and whatever clandestine agencies in the U.S. government were involved in it. That was what they used, the scenario they used to facilitate his neutralization, as they called it, and use a CIA term on it. But again, my contention is that Malcolm had not necessarily outgrown the Nation of Islam. He just saw the struggle from a different perspective. So in my view, it was inevitable that he would leave and join the fray, get involved. And the fact that he was making friends and making linkages and making connections and trying to establish a network of leaders in Africa, in the Muslim world, in the United Nations, to buttress his case to take the United States before the world court made him an even deeper threat. Because keep in mind, he'd already come out against the war in Vietnam well before the escalation to the point where it began to become all-consuming. He talked about it. He talked about it within the context of global white supremacy and imperialism. And so these things were no-nos. And the important part that I want us to get as we listen to Malcolm talk about human rights is that he elevated it beyond the jurisdiction of the U.S. laws, because they were just that, laws. And he saw the travail and the problems that King was having changing the laws. And so he took it to another level. Don't even deal with those laws. These are immoral. Again, he had the mirror of the brutality, the savagery, the barbarism, the apartheid. And so clearly those were violations of human rights. And he planned to use that in his case. And if nothing else, it would have been embarrassing. Now, obviously, the United States would have exerted whatever pressure it could on its allies, the West, you know, France, any other allies, to squash anything that came through the UN. But nonetheless, there was enough interest and there was enough cordiality amongst many of the so-called third world or emerging nations that the United States would be forced to deal with it in terms of the embarrassment. And so that's one of the reasons that they killed him, because they deemed him a threat. They deemed him a threat to their image, because they were the good guys. They wore the white hats. And keep in mind, this was during the quote-unquote Cold War era. And so to allow him to do that would have given a large propaganda edge to the so-called adversary, the Soviets, the communists, and may have swayed some non-aligned nations on some issues against the United States. Of course, they had money in the form of quote-unquote foreign aid, and they had intimidation and all that, but nonetheless, on the world stage, world opinion would definitely have turned against the United States. And that is the genius of Malcolm, not only to think it, but to move on it almost single-handedly. I mean, he didn't have a large organization. There wasn't a whole lot of people. He had a small core within the Organization of Afro-American Unity, and more than likely some of them were snitches and people who had infiltrated the organization. So we're going to listen to his take on human rights and see his evolution from that regard and that perspective, because it is really ingenious. Now, again, Paul Robeson had attempted to do it earlier, about a generation or so earlier, the 30s and 40s, and had been rebuffed because he didn't have the UN. He didn't have access. Once the United States found out what he was up to, they took away his passport. They prevented him from making a living by going to sing or act or, you know, Hollywood black white balding, and that pretty much finished him. Whereas Malcolm had use of more advanced technology, the closeness, the UN, the ambassadors, the representatives, the delegates were already there. Plus, he was traveling, making connections and making linkages. And that's what that's the lesson we have to learn. Use the technology, use the time as an asset, as an ally. And so we'll listen, but we need to learn the lesson. And this is a mighty lesson from a great teacher. Give an ear.
So, brothers and sisters, since we can see that the Uncle Sam has failed us, and he has failed us. Eastland is part of Uncle Sam. Governor, Senator Russell, that's Uncle Sam. Goldwater, that's Uncle Sam. He's just as much Uncle Sam as Javits and Keating and the rest of them. All of them are part of the same system, and it is the system that is being used to deprive you and me of our rights. It's not a Southern senator. It's the system. The Southern senator is using an outdated system, an antiquated system, a very tricky and treacherous system to further the political oppression and the political exploitation of 22 million black people in this country. So what must we do? As long as we're running around here asking the white man for civil rights, we're at his mercy. As long as we're in Washington, D.C. asking him for civil rights, we're at his mercy. The entire civil rights program has to be expanded. Expanded from the level of civil rights to the level of human rights. When you take it from the level of civil rights and put it on the level of human rights, you internationalize the problem. And when you internationalize it, you open the gate for support from every nation on this planet who is for the human rights of mankind. It's true that it's within the power of Uncle Sam to give or not give you and me civil rights. But human rights are something that you have when you're born. Human rights involves the right to be a human being. And in the United Nations Charter, you have what's known as the Covenant on Human Rights. The Declaration of Human Rights. There are committees that are set up in the UN for the sole purpose of fighting for the human rights of downtrodden people all over this earth. And now the human rights of the people in South Africa have been taken before the United Nations. The human rights of our people in Angola and Mozambique and the Congo has gone before the United Nations. It's not an accident that your and my plight has never reached the UN. You and I are more thoroughly trodden upon and exploited and spat upon than our brothers in South Africa and Angola and Mozambique and all other parts of this earth. But there has been a conspiracy to keep you and me barking up the civil rights tree so we wouldn't be aware of the human rights tree.
And as we close out our attempt to pay homage to El-Haj Malik El-Shabaab, to shed some light on why he's so important, share his voice, his own words, because he's been examined every facet, now wants to take credit for him. Several years ago, they issued a stamp, and probably that's the last thing that Malcolm would want is a stamp from the United States Postal Service with his visage on it. The left, the communists, everybody wants to claim Malcolm because he's such a pivotal figure. And we need to use him as a beacon, a shining star, our black prince, as Ossie Davis said when he eulogized him. And unfortunately, we're out of time, so I can't even share the eulogy. There's some other clippings I wanted to share about his insight about the political process and how relevant it is today. I tried to attempt to get you to see that during in my commentary on what would Malcolm say about Obama. But Malcolm talked about the process. He was clear that it was not in the best interest of black folks to try to grapple and wrestle with this system. That's why he took it to another level, attempted to bring it on the world stage, hoping against hope that the United States would mend its ways. But obviously, they didn't and they haven't. So here we are. The question is, what are we going to do? Are we going to allow this model and teaching and example of personal redemption to go to waste? Or are we going to step up and do what needs to be done to redeem ourselves, our people, and ultimately the planet? Food for thought. Till next time, stay strong.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery invades, where no military.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates, no denomination faith dominates, and no court is going to try any.